Hello, I'm Nancy Mendoza, Director of Communications and Membership at the Canary. Welcome to this week's Canary Pod. We decided after our recording on Friday morning that there was so much great stuff, we'd give you two Canary Pods this week. So this is the continuation of the conversation between our Editor-in-Chief, Kerri-Anne Mendoza, and Canary writer Steve Topple. They're discussing two stories. Later on, we're going to hear about an extraordinary protest by DPAC, Disabled People Against Cuts, that took place during the last Prime Minister's questions of this Parliament, and it's quite a good one. First of all, we're going to go to a story which is quite difficult but also incredibly important that we discuss this. It's about the way that people who, as children, experienced rape and sexual abuse have been treated under a scheme which was designed to support and compensate people who have had those sorts of experiences. Just one note, during the recording, Kerri-Anne actually quotes a figure. The figure's incorrect, we've checked it back, and she says £27,000. The figure is actually £37,000. So just bear that in mind when you're listening. Over to Kerri-Anne and Steve.
Shall we begin with this one, which just absolutely took my breath away when I read the headline? Headline was, Theresa May's government won't compensate children who were raped. It says they consented to the abuse. Steve, what is going on?
Yeah, okay. So there's a government agency which is called the Criminal Injuries Compensation Authority, or CICA, as it's more commonly known, and a Freedom of Information request that was submitted by five charities, including Barnardo's, Victim Support, Liberty, Rape Crisis, and the National Working Group, found that CICA had refused to compensate over 700 children who had either been raped or sexually assaulted. Now, the reasoning that CICA gave for much of these denials of compensation was essentially that these children consented to the abuse that they were put through. As you say, you kind of stop and think, okay, am I reading this right? Is this actually correct? And that was the reaction I had from a lot of people on social media. They were like, is this actually true? Has this actually happened? But unfortunately, it is actually true. The challenge with this story is, and the problem with CICA is, that there's the definition of consent in law, which obviously consents says that anyone under the age of 16 cannot consent to sexual activity. And then there's consent in fact, if you like, where CICA have been ruling that these children, if you like, agreed and were party to getting at times into a relationship with their abusers, or consented to the abuse itself. Now, obviously,
for people listening, I mean, frame it. Can you give us any specific examples or scenarios where this
I can give you a perfect example. There was a huge story, it was in 2016, about a 14-year-old girl who'd been repeatedly raped and assaulted by a group of around 30 men. This was a big story at the time. And these men were prosecuted, but there was some controversy at the time because both the Mirror and the Sun, and I remember it distinctly, basically said that this girl agreed to have sex with these men. Now, this girl was 14, and Barnardo specifically said that what CICA's judgments are doing is essentially ignoring the fact that these children have been groomed, they've been coerced, they've been misled into believing that any relations they have with the perpetrators are okay. Essentially, they're whitewashing over all the evidence about how children come to be raped and sexually assaulted, and just looking at it with a real black and white, if you like, perspective.
Yeah, so they would probably argue that anything that wasn't forcibly coerced in the terms of physical force would somehow count as consent, when obviously we know there are a range of other measures that can be applied to force consent from a human being.
Absolutely. But I think the most preposterous element of this story was that the majority of the perpetrators against these 700 children have been bloody well jailed.
Yeah.
They been charged and they'd gone to prison for these crimes, and yet in the eyes of this government agency, no, they consented, so not compensating them. But there's a point I want to make on this, and I think it's important. A lot of the media, and I'm not saying they do this in a nefarious way or for some intentionally underlying reason, but a lot of the media tend to dumb down stories about these kind of issues by repeatedly referring to it as child abuse and referring to the individuals as victims. Now, while it's obviously down to each person who's been subject to some of this horrific ordeals to decide if they are a victim or survivor, most campaign groups say that the language used should be survivor. But for me, there is a real issue with the way the media portrays these incidents as child sexual abuse. It's almost like dumbing down, and I think, and I made the point of doing it in my report, and I think we should all be doing it. It's not abuse, it is the rape and sexual assault of children. I don't know if they do it because they think the public can't maybe handle that in terms of that kind of language, but we should be calling it for what it is. It's rape and sexual assault, and there's a real kind of issue there in the UK press, in my opinion. Mm.
No, I agree. I can remember when, you know, we had the sort of the Jimmy Savile rape cases kind of emerging, and that whole conversation. I can remember having discussions with a feminist group about it, and they were repeatedly asking, you know, why are these people being referred to as paedophiles? You know, when the word paedophile was invented by child rapists, you know, and as a coin they termed themselves to create themselves as a sexuality, as legitimate as heterosexuality or bisexuality or homosexuality. And I mean, it's a really valid point, you know, and people can say, oh, you're playing semantics, but words are really important.
Really, absolutely. You
know, obviously, you know, given our profession, we know this to be true. You know, see, if you cast something as, you know, child abuse, you cast it as paedophilia instead of what it is, which is, you know, it's raping someone. It's forcibly, you know, having sex with someone who does not want to, you know, be violated in that way by you.
It's extremely important. It's kind of along the same basis of the argument as should images of war crimes and what have you been shown. I think I don't want to say dumbing down, but it kind of is. It's sort of filtering out the most horrific elements, if you like, to make it more palatable for the public, when I think it needs to be as unpalatable as possible, because it's some of the most horrific crimes that can be possibly committed by a human being.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, we had this debate ourselves, didn't we? I think, you know, shortly after we'd launched, I ran a story about suicide, which was a junior doctor called Rose Polge had committed suicide, and she'd actually referenced in her suicide note about the impact of, you know, Jeremy Hunt and his, you know, his behaviour and his kind of war on junior doctors, which is obviously an entirely legitimate story to be telling people, you know, especially in the context, as we've seen from multiple reports about, you know, the level of, you know, mental strain, mental illness, a rise in the use of antidepressants by junior doctors and nurses alike because of the pressures that are being put on them at work, you know, which don't begin and end when they are at work. So a really, really big issue. And you know, you could all recall the furore about that. We got, you know, how dare you, you know, report this? And, you know, our response was, hang on a minute. This was not your approach with, you know, Palestinian suicide bombers. You know, you couldn't rush quickly enough to publish, about them when you wanted to demonize the Palestinian community, you know. But it's like, if you go anywhere near the establishment with this kind of stuff, they tend to have, suddenly there are completely different rules about, you know, the way that these things need to be reported. And I think you're absolutely right, Steve, to actually draw on that level here, you know, when it is something as grievous as what we're witnessing. So Steve, I mean, what action is being taken about this? Are there any campaign groups involved? Are there any NGOs involved? You know, is this just an issue that we've just found and highlighted, or are there already voices in civil society calling for this to be changed?
Okay, the thing is with this, this is not really a new story, if you like. Bernardo's, for example, when they submitted their evidence to the independent inquiry into historical allegations of child sexual abuse. Just quickly, another issue with semantics there, historical, implying that it's not going on today, when the report into the BBC's situation with Jimmy Savile was saying that it probably still is going on today. But Bernardo submitted evidence to this inquiry last year about Seeker specifically, and they specifically said that there were concerns that Seeker's apparent lack of understanding on the issue of abuse, rape, assault and exploitation can cause distress to young people who've been the victims of these crimes. And it also talked about grooming, saying that basically Seeker don't seem to understand or don't seem to want to differentiate between these issues. So this has already been raised. But I think the challenge is with Seeker and what they do, it's not governed by legislation, if you like. It is purely done on a case-by-case basis. So the legislation around it is fairly minimal, if you like. That's why they can do where ignore consent as it's stated by law and base it on consent stated by what they consider fact. As I said, the reaction on my social media was quite huge, and it was interesting because this was one of the biggest stories for us of the week. It had been widely reported in the media before I waded into it, if you like. The Guardian had reported on it, The Independent reported on it. But I think and I hope it's possibly telling that it was some reflection on the way I did report it, because I did report it as I see it.
And as the law sees it.
This is ongoing, and it has been ongoing for quite a while, so whether we'll see any movement on I don't know. I mean, Bernardo's are campaigning. Will the government listen? I doubt it's up their priority list very high, to be honest.
I would actually be really interested to see what level austerity has played on this as well, because obviously we know that that Seeker have basically had their budget halved by the government. There was about 18 months, 2 years ago now, where the government came out and said, we're going to give them £800,000 more a year for this specific thing, while literally having the rest of their budget with the other hand. So it was, this kind of just typical what we've come to expect really since 2010 of just, this headline figure of, oh, that's really good news, they're going to invest in this. And then, you read the small print and actually more than double that is coming out.
Absolutely. And of course, I mean, the kind of cases we're talking about are probably some of the most complex cases for Seeker to deal with. It's in my mind, it is probably easier for them to fob off, if you like, victims and survivors of this than it is, say, in other cases, because of the complexity and the nature of the case. And plus, because these people probably don't want really to have to rake all this up again.
Absolutely. I mean, just to put this in perspective for people as well, because I'm conscious there may be listeners who are saying, Seeker, who's this? Like, what? Where's this come from? So I first started looking at this a few years ago. I think it was when I was still writing the Scriptonite Daily blog. There was a Channel 4 documentary on called The Murder Workers. I don't know if you guys remember this. And literally buried in the middle of this documentary was this throwaway line about sort of crime scene cleanup and the costs to families who, their loved ones have been victims of murder or manslaughter. Mm. They've ended up dead anyway through crime. And I went away and did some digging afterwards. And it turns out like the families who've had someone murdered were paying on average £27,000.
What?
Related to the murder. So this was crime scene cleanup, like body retrieval, this like list of costs that would be incurred by the families of the victims. And I just couldn't believe it. And then people were going bankrupt. It was like something in like really high number. It was something like 50% of families who'd lost someone to murder or manslaughter went bankrupt because of the costs associated with it. Now, especially if they were murdered overseas, because then you've got the repatriation costs as well. And so it could even go up to like £100,000 if you're bringing someone back, from the other side of the world. And I was just, could not believe what I was seeing, and kind of went and started talking to the victim support unit that kind of try and help people. And the story there was that, you know, that this was only going to get worse because of the cuts that were happening to Seeker and happening to homicide support. These costs were going to grow because at least at that point, I think you could claim back like £5,000 or something from homicide support. It's still nowhere near the 27 you've already spent, but, you know, you're getting something back. So it's not, you know, it's not like this is an isolated incident here that we're talking about with victims of crime, you know, be it rape or murder or manslaughter, you know, either them or their families having to really pay an additional price and almost be victimized all over again, you know, by a justice system and a regulatory system and a system built essentially just to drive down costs and not to actually fulfill a public service.
It's interesting you raise that because that also kind of feeds into another sort of overriding thing I took from this whole story. Was that essentially what this is also doing again is pushing the onus and pushing the responsibility away from the state and onto the individual with this. It's Seeker's actions and their attitude, if you like, is kind of absolving the state of any responsibility. I don't know if I go so far to say victim blaming in the case of Seeker, but it kind of felt a bit like that. But with what you were referencing and this specific case I wrote on, well, it's taking responsibility away from the state and the government and shoving it all onto victims and survivors, essentially. Interesting.
Outrageous. So thanks for that one, Steve. And as we say, we'll in the notes of today's podcast, you'll have a link to the story that Steve's covered so you can read about it in more detail. I'm going to stick with you, Steve, for the next story as well.
Hello, it's Nancy here again. For those who are new to Canary Pod, I wanted to let you know how to get in touch with us. You can find us on Twitter at Canary Pod, or you can email podcast@thecanary.co. This week, there's a specific question that we want to ask you, so we'd love it if you could all go over to Twitter, where we'll be running a poll. What we want to know is, when would you like Canary Pod to be published? At the moment, we're mainly publishing on a Friday night or a Sunday night. We wonder whether that's a good time for all of you. So your options are a Friday evening, a Sunday evening, a Monday evening, or if you really don't mind, you can just click I don't mind. We look forward to hearing from you and we'll let you know the result of the poll on next week's Canary Pod. Back to Kerri-Anne and Steve.
Changing gear, we actually wanted to take a look at Prime Minister's questions this week. So obviously it was Theresa May's last PMQs before the summer break. I think a lot of us are asking, is it her last PMQs full stop? One can only hope. But while lots of focus was in the House of Commons, your focus was just slightly outside the House of Commons, Steve. What was going on that we couldn't see on the BBC cameras?
It was, yes. Okay, so I went down to Parliament on Wednesday and I was there supporting and reporting on a group called Disabled People Against Cuts, who I've been involved with for many years now and constantly try and raise their profile when I can because they do excellent, excellent work. And DPAC, as they're known for short, had organised a lobby of MPs in Parliament. This was an official lobby. It was all done by the book because democratic mechanisms in this country mean that anyone can go into central lobby in Parliament, write on a bit of paper that they want to see their MP about a certain issue, and the MP is obliged, not forced, but they are obliged to come out and talk to their constituent about whatever issue they wish to discuss. So DPAC had organised...
I wonder how many people know that. More now.
Quite, yes. Yes. I hope you're all taking note, listeners. You can rock up at Parliament and demand to see your MP. But anyway, so DPAC organised a en masse, if you like, lobby of MPs in Parliament. It was... more about it was an overarching kind of lobby, if you like, about the sustained cuts and what Deepak referred to as a tax that disabled people have been subject to since 2010, if not slightly before, by the coalition government and then the successive Conservative government. So it was they're currently doing a whole week of action, which is called Summer of Discontent, where they're doing various actions on each day and raising awareness of disabled people's rights in this country and trying to bring to the fore just what has been happening to disabled people. So there was a lobby. With Deepak, everything they do, it's always very noisy, very in your face, and this was no exception. And a lot of MPs came out because it was interrupting, the noise was interrupting PMQs. I had one Labour MP, who I won't mention, tell one of Deepak's members to keep the noise down.
The Labour MP?
It was a Labour MP, yes. I didn't name her in my article because I didn't think that would be fair.
Why?
because I didn't get a chance to give her a right of reply.
Oh, fair play.
So I thought no. But yes.
Tell me all fair.
There was some good responses. Caroline Lucas and Jonathan Bartley, co-leaders of the Green Party, came out. Jeremy Corbyn came down, contrary to every other single media report, who said Jeremy Corbyn just walked through. He didn't. He stopped and spoke to me, and we had a quick chat, and he also quickly spoke to some members of Deepak. John McDonnell was down for a lot of the time, talking to Deepak members. Both Corbyn and McDonnell are big supporters of Deepak. They've been supportive of them since the group was formed in 2010.
Yeah.
So, yeah, noisy lobby, raising awareness of issues of disability rights in this country. But a lot of there's a lot of sort of things that we could springboard off about that.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And, you know, both of us have been involved, you know, as journalists, but as activists as well, you know, since, you know, Deepak was formed. And, you know, I mean, it's almost impossible to list at this stage, you know, the ways in which austerity has been like a hammer to beat sick and disabled people in this country. I mean, it's almost impossible to embellish because the reality is so disturbing.
Yes.
And I completely understand their point, which is, you know, we had uproar about the dementia tax, you know, which was something that was perceived to be something that could affect all of us, or at least all of us who could afford a home, which is, you know, only half of us. And yet for years, you know, sick and disabled people have been just suffering the most extraordinary indignities at the hands of, you know, successive austerity governments.
Yes.
And, you know, there's been coverage, there's been reporting, but it's just like there hasn't been, you know, apart from maybe the bedroom tax, there hasn't really been something that's galvanised people and actually looked like it could threaten the government, you know, as in, like, oh my God, this is going to topple the government, this issue, in the way that it felt like the dementia tax, you know, basically toppled Theresa May's government before it began. You know, it killed her chances of a majority before they, before the general election.
No, absolutely. I mean, this is one of the points Deepak made with this lobbying protest, that there was a lot of public outrage about Theresa May's planned cuts to social care for older people.
Yeah.
However, cuts to disabled people's social support and right to independent living and right to function as a quote unquote normal member of society has been going on for 7 years.
Yeah.
And it sporadically hits the headlines. I mean, when Deepak do actions like this, the press are always all over it, because I'm going to say it, because most of the press see it as a bit of a novelty.
I'd agree. I think you can see from the tone of the articles that's abundantly clear. I mean, it's incredibly patronising.
Yeah.
The way that they're playing. It's always, look at those cute little disabled people in their wheelchairs.
That's exactly it. And it's always sloppy journalism as well. It's always, they basically pull some things off Twitter, put that people in wheelchairs were making a bit of a noise, and that's kind of the end of it. There's never any context about why they're actually making this noise. There's always a sort of bit of a storm, if you like, when Deepak do things like this, but there's never any overarching analysis, if you like, of just what's happened. But for me, I mean, there's sort of two important points for me. One is that I am sick of writing about this.
Yeah, me too.
It's sort of every couple of weeks I seem to be doing something about the violations of disabled people's rights in this country. And it's just, it's draining, just keep writing about it. And if I'm bloody drained, then I dread to think how disabled people actually feel. I mean, I know how they feel. I talk to them all the time. I went to another protest outside the Department for Transport about disabled people's access to rail, which is shocking. I didn't know. Only one in five stations in the UK actually has step-free access. I didn't know that. It's just unbelievable in 2017. Yeah. So I went to another protest yesterday, and I got the train home with a good friend who's also one of the sort of lead activists with DPAC. And she was saying she's just exhausted by it all. And this is aside from her dealings with the Department for Work and Pensions, aside from managing her own illness. She's exhausted by constantly having to fight this. But the problem is, they have very little left. I mean, some of the cuts that have been made to disabled people's support, like, for example, we've seen 51,000 people lose their mobility vehicles. There's been a 55% a week cut to ESA for sick and disabled 18 to 25-year-olds. There was the storm about PIP, personal independent payments, being cut from 164,000 people living with mental health issues. And this is aside from all this they have to put up with. These people constantly have to fight. They're constantly fighting. But the other point I'd like to raise is there is something which galvanizes it all, and it's something I bang on about all the time. It's the fact there have been three damned UN reports in the past year slamming the Conservative-led governments of the past 7 years into what they deem and what they call grave and systematic violations of disabled people's human rights. I mean, the UN, its specific report by its Disability Committee, it was the first report of its kind on the planet. It was the first time that the UN had had to intervene in a country over their treatment of disabled people. And for me, that encapsulates it. There was also the first UN report was only comparable in the tranche of reports that were done at the time. There's six reports done. UK was one of them. Only comparable to Honduras's report, a country that is on both the US and the UK international advice list for tourists as being extremely dangerous and you shouldn't travel there. Just beggars belief. And these reports have been damning. And this, and I'm no fan of the UN. You know, I find them hand-wringing. I find them particularly ineffective. And if you like, they are more just a body to maintain the status quo in a lot of respects. However, you cannot ignore the fact that they are an international organization, the most esteemed in many people's eyes international organization in the world, and they've repeatedly slammed the Tories for violating disabled people's human rights.
Well, I think you're touching on something which is a broader point again, which is about, you know, look at where Britain is in the league tables on everything at the moment. You know, we don't seem to be advancing in any direction that you care to look, whether it's the global education tables, I mean, the press freedom index, which we've discussed before, which is, I mean, it's just breathtaking. I often now when I'm doing talks, this is a point I raise with people is, you know, according to the press freedom index of 2017, where would you think the UK ranks? You know, and you say, well, top three, top five. Top 10, we're 40th, we're behind Suriname. I think, you know, our view of, you know, almost like the civilization of our nation, I think is far in advance of where it actually lies. You know, our view of our treatment of each other.
What we're watching and witnessing is almost the degradation of society, if you like, in this country. It's slowly being eroded away, all in the name of corporatist interests and corporatism. And you can witness this everywhere. There was a fascinating quote, and I cannot for the life of me remember who it was, but someone said last month that historians will look back at this period in history and compare it to Victorian times, the way that those on the bottom rungs of society, the working and underclass, are being treated, and the way society is imploding, if you like. And
absolutely.
There's sort of nuggets everywhere which point to this, and the challenge is for us as journalists, but also society as a whole and civil society groups and NGOs and campaigners, the challenge is piecing it all together and coming up with one narrative which covers all of this, if you like, which really hammers the message home to the public that, look, open your eyes, see what's happening, and we need to do something about it.
Absolutely, completely agreed. So, Steve, I mean, I'm aware that, I mean, I'm sitting here quite agitated looking at these, you know, the things that are happening to disabled people in this country and the absence of seemingly any action about it. I mean, if our listeners are feeling the same, what can they do? You know, what can they actually do themselves to try and change this situation?
Sure. The best thing you can do is, firstly, follow the work that DPAC do. They do some excellent campaigning and raising of issues which are really crucial to disabled people. You can check out their website, which is DPAC, that's dpac.uk.net. Also, follow what's going on with the UN reports. There's going to be a lot about this coming out from DPAC over the course of August. DPAC are in Geneva in Switzerland because there's a second meeting of the UN committee that called the Conservative government as committing grave and systematic violations of disabled people's human rights. That's going on in August. So keep your eyes peeled for stuff coming out of the UN. But most importantly, support DPAC. It's dpac.uk.net.
Brilliant. Thanks, Steve. Pop.